Hi, this is Nancy Clare. Welcome to episode 96 of Speaking of Mysteries. Our guest is Hester Young, whose debut mystery novel, The Gates of Evangeline, has just been released in paperback. Hester and I also talk about The Shimmering Road, the second novel in the series that features her protagonist, Charlotte Charlie Cates, which is scheduled for publication in February 2017. I saw on Hester's Twitter page that she likes semicolons and the Oxford comma. I'm a bit of a punctuation nerd myself, so at the end of the interview, we talk about the pros and cons of serial, otherwise known as Oxford commas. Are Oxford commas maybe too much of a good thing, or do they serve the noble purpose of clarification? Here's Hester Young. Welcome back to Speaking of Mysteries. This is Nancy Clare, and our guest today is Hester Young, who has written an amazing mystery called The Gates of Evangeline, which actually came out in 2015, but the paperback has just been released. And this is also in anticipation of the second in the series, The Shimmering Road, which will be out in February. Welcome, Hester.
Thank you so much for having me.
The Gates of Evangeline is your debut mystery, and it starts with an unspeakable tragedy, which actually triggers the dreams that drive Charlotte Charlie Cates, your protagonist, literally and figuratively forward.
Yeah, dreams have always been a sort of interesting presence in my own life, and so I was interested to have a protagonist who had them kind of swirling around as a weird backdrop, motivating some of her action.
You actually, I remember when we met, you told a story of a family member who had a gift like Charlie's. And we should say, that doesn't spoil the book, that Charlie has dreams that she realizes are true. But she can't place them in time necessarily. And you told a story of a family member who had a similar gift or curse. And I remember it triggered a rousing conversation among the people who were listening.
The story was about my grandmother, Margaret, who was a New York City woman, much like Charlie, a professional woman, which was unusual for the place where she lived. And she had a four-year-old son named Bobby. And when Bobby was about 4 years old, my grandmother began to have this recurring nightmare about him. She would be washing dishes in the dream, and she would look out the window, and she would see something fall from the floor above, and she would just know it was Bobby, and she would run outside calling his name. And when she got there, there would be nothing except this smashed melon on the ground. So she had this dream several times and was really haunted by it. And I should add that Bobby had been born with hydrocephalus, so he was unable to speak as a result of that. He had suffered some mental retardation from birth. So anyway, my grandmother left Bobby in the care of her parents one day, and somehow a window was left open, and Bobby did indeed fall from it. And my grandmother went to the hospital afterwards trying to figure out the extent of his injuries. And a doctor came and told her that her son's head had been crushed like a melon from the fall. And it had, in fact, been fatal. So it was a pretty horrible story and a horrible premonition to have. But the sort of postscript to that is that a few days later, my grandmother woke up in the night and she saw Bobby standing at the foot of her bed. And this little boy who had never been able to speak to her in life told her, "I'm okay now, mommy, it's okay." And she was tremendously comforted by his words. So this story of my grandmother's was very remarkable to me because of the kind of person my grandmother was. She had been raised Catholic, but she was not by any means a woman of faith. She considered herself an atheist. She was, as my character in the book, Charlie, is, very skeptical about God and the existence of things you can't, you know, see. So that she had this experience and still, into her 80s, absolutely believed that it was real and had occurred, and that her boy had been in the room with her that night. That always really stayed with me. And so it was definitely part of the inspiration for writing this book and creating this character.
I'm wondering if in the years since the book has been written, if other people have shared similar stories, or books like this always cause a reaction, I think, among people who've read them. They either think, yeah, you know, I know someone who that happened to, or similar thing happened to, or it happened to me, or it's completely bunk. So it's the kind of story, I think, that would elicit strong reactions from some people.
Yeah, and I aimed to write a story that you certainly don't have to believe in any of this, to just enjoy it as a story. But certainly there have been people who read it, who have reached out to me in person, in email, in various ways, to share with me similar experiences that they have had. An old man came up to me after a reading one time and told me about a premonitory dream he'd had about the death of his wife, a very specific dream that told him that it was going to be a problem with her heart and it was going to happen in their kitchen. And that was indeed how his wife passed away, I guess, weeks later. And when I was doing research for the second book in the series, I had a rather unlikely source share a dream like this. I was at Customs and Border Protection because my second book is set in Arizona, and I was kind of touring with this woman. He's a very tough Border Patrol agent, really no nonsense. And she said, "Oh, so I see you write these books about this woman who like dreams stuff and then it happens." And I was feeling embarrassed and thinking she was judging me and thinking I was some kind of flake. And I was like, "Yeah, that's what I write about." She said, "You know, that happened to me." And she told me this really haunting story of a dream that she had had about her husband's best friend. And it was a dream that absolutely foresaw his suicide, which happened that very same night. She learned the next morning that her husband's best friend had killed himself, and she felt very strongly that the dream she'd had about him was him asking her to look after her husband in his absence. So it surprised me, I think, some of the people that seem very, very down to earth and yet have had these unusual experiences.
Well, I guess that brings me to... well, first of all, it always makes me think of, it brings me to a question about genre. When I read this, I sort of asked myself, is this a mystery with supernatural elements or a novel of the supernatural that includes a mystery? And it's described in the press literature as a literary suspense with romance and a mystical twist. You wrote it. How do you see it?
I'm so glad that I don't have to market it because I do think I read a lot of genres and I love suspense. I love thrillers. I love a good ghost story. I love Southern works of fiction. I didn't even know that Southern Gothic was a genre. But after writing this, everyone was telling me, "Oh, you wrote a Southern Gothic novel." And then as I learned about it, I thought, "Oh yeah, of course I did." I have always been in love with Tennessee Williams and, you know, these old decrepit homes and fallen families and So it made absolute sense that I had written that. Yeah, I think there are a lot of different elements in play, and it is sort of hard to distill it into a single genre. But I would say probably suspense or mystery more than anything else, because I think if you like a good suspense novel or a good mystery, you don't need to care about the other elements to really enjoy this book.
And it truly is a mystery. I mean, I read it as a mystery with supernatural elements, and I have air quotes around that word because it was just part of Charlie. And I guess this would be a good place to briefly describe the story of Charlie, who has a terrible thing happen to her, and she leaves her job as an editor in a fancy New York City magazine. And by the way, having been an editor, not at a New York magazine, but in a magazine, you have that nailed. You have that description absolutely down. And she goes to the anti-Manhattan. She goes to rural Bayou Country, Louisiana. And at this point, I'll let you give a brief synopsis without spoilers.
Sure. So one of her dreams kind of collides with her professional life as a journalist to bring her to this old plantation home in a little town called Sickery, where 30 years earlier, the young son of this very prestigious, wealthy Louisiana family, the young son was kidnapped, and no one has ever solved this case. So Charlie is down there ostensibly writing a book with this family, but guided by this dream that she has had about the child to try to figure out what happened to him. She kind of gets to know local law enforcement, and things start rolling down the hill from there, and she gets a lot more than she bargained for.
You know, it's funny because you named all the genres, Southern Gothic, a ghost story, all of these, mystery, suspense. I saw it a bit also as a fish out of water story. She's a Manhattan, you know, a sort of fancy pants journalist from Manhattan who's goes to Southern Louisiana, and it could not be more different.
Yeah, I have family myself in Louisiana, and I love the South. There's a lot of things about Southern culture that I really enjoy. And so I was interested in taking this kind of transplanted Northerner, and instead of exploring Southern prejudices, which I think plenty of people talk about and imagine and think about, looking at some of the prejudices that she as a Northerner brought down with her, not all of which were wrong, but watching her grow as a person and kind of understanding the culture more and coming to appreciate elements of it as she spends time at this plantation home and gets to know the hired help that work there.
I found it a unique perspective because for Northerners, and I think we should mention that you grew up in Hawaii and have lived in Arizona and now live on the East Coast of the United States. So you've definitely, and you've said you have family in Louisiana, you have seen lots of aspects of our country, and they are very, very different.
I actually grew up in Boston, but I did live in Hawaii, as you mentioned, and also Arizona. I'm in New Jersey now. I lived in London, and I have family all over the place, Oklahoma, Colorado, Missouri. As you say, I have a lot of different places around the country that I feel connected to, and it's very interesting to me to kind of compare the different cultures within our country and look at what it feels like to be an outsider in all of those different cultures and how people treat you, because I have been an outsider so many times myself. And I think that's actually a pretty comfortable perspective for a writer.
If you don't mind talking a little bit about your book that's coming out in February, The Shimmering Road. At the end of The Gates of Evangeline, lots had changed for Charlie, lots of things. But I'm hoping as this book, the new book, comes out, that she still has her gift and she's going to use it for the forces of good.
It's interesting in the second book because it's really Charlie kind of delving into her own family history, which is a very painful one. And you don't see as much of that in The Gates of Evangeline. You get some hints about where she came from. But the second book is really her getting pulled back into this world of her mother, a mother who abandoned her as a toddler and turns up dead in Arizona. And so Charlie is out there sort of unwillingly because she discovers a niece that she didn't know she had that needs someone to care for her and has no parents now. So it's really about Charlie confronting her own past and how her gift plays into that. And there's certainly a mystery at the heart of it, the way that her mother and a sister that she didn't know she had died rather brutally. So she's sort of unwillingly sucked into that murder, and her gift plays into it. So yes, she's using her gift for forces of good, but in a much more personal way than in the first book, I think.
When you first conceived of the story for The Gates of Evangeline, did you always see it as a series? Do you have a finite number of books in mind, or is it a trilogy, or four books or five books? It's always very interesting to talk to writers of series. For this reason, alone, like, how do you conceive it?
I began just purely with one book in mind. And when I got to the end, there were so many changes for Charlie, and she was just in a different place with her gift and with her life. And I thought it would be interesting to see what happened next to her. I am a writer that's very inspired by place. As you said, the sort of fish out of water story is one that I'd like to explore. What happens when you take a character out of their normal element and put them somewhere else? And so the second book is very much doing that, taking Charlie out of the world that she knows and plopping her this time in Arizona, which is another place that I used to live, have great fondness for, and I think is not necessarily a very understood place. I lived in Tucson, and that's where much of the book takes place. And I love just exploring that. So I knew I wanted to do some more places and see what would happen to Charlie if I put her in a few different places, some really different environments with really different cultures, and let the place sort of determine the mystery that happens, that she's entangled in. So when I was discussing with my editor what we wanted to do and what we envisioned as kind of the future for the book, we both thought a trilogy would be a lot of fun, and taking the places of Louisiana and Bayou Country, taking the desert of Arizona, where I used to live, and also Hawaii, where I used to live. So the third book that I'm working on right now, which will be the final book of the trilogy, is a mystery set in Hawaii. And it's been really interesting to see how these different environments really do interact with the mood of the piece and just change the plot and the story and shape the character, too.
I think a trilogy is wonderful, but I think those who haven't read the books are going to fall so in love with her, they're going to want more, and then you're going to have the tyranny of the series.
But I have a feeling maybe you have thought beyond this trilogy to your next idea.
Yeah, I do have some other books waiting in the wings. So maybe when I finish these three and get to try another couple of projects, it would be fun to come back to Charlie. But after 1,200 pages with the same character, you kind of need a little breather.
My partner in Speaking of Mysteries, Les Klinger, is often asked the question of writers that he interviews. He said the gift and the curse of series is that everybody loves what you do, and they want exactly the same thing, only different. And so
yeah, and I think that's kind of what I was going for with the different setting. I felt that I didn't want to tell the same story over and over and over. But you do have a certain kind of format that your readers become accustomed to and enjoy and expect and look forward to. So I wanted to be able to give a similar format in these three books, but to give each book a very different feeling and experience.
Now I want to shift off topic just a tiny bit from your mystery writing, but still staying in your writing world. I went to your Twitter page and I saw your description, and I agree with you on the semicolon, but the Oxford comma to me is anathema, and it seems like comma overkill. And so I was wondering, what can you tell me about the Oxford comma that's going to change my mind?
I think that it's not what I could tell you, but if you look around Twitter, there are some really wonderful examples of when you don't have an Oxford comma, the confusion that it can cause. I would have to send you one of them. Some of them are not the most appropriate examples, but for clarity's sake, I'm someone that just likes very clear, easy writing. And to me, if you don't have that Oxford comma, I'm always feeling confused.
We should explain to those who don't understand what an Oxford comma is. It is that extra comma when you have a series of three things, let's say, X, Y, and Z. You would have a comma after X. With an Oxford comma, you would also have a comma after Y before the and. So, it's a hot topic among grammar wonks.
I believe everyone has the right to determine whether or not they use an Oxford comma, but I will always go with the comma. My loyalties are to the Oxford comma.
Thank you so much for your time today talking about The Gates of Evangeline and your next book, The Shimmering Road. I hope we get a chance to talk after that one's released, because I'm completely committed to Charlie Gates and I want to see her story through.
Oh, good. Well, you will learn a lot more about her, and her life will take some very interesting and sharp turns in that second book, so I hope you'll enjoy it.